Since 2015, at least 600 people have been injured or killed by guns in central and southern Illinois. Sarah Fager's boyfriend, John Bell, died last month after he was shot in Peoria.
All these young boys and young men are getting killed, and it's like there's nothing happening in consequence to it. It's just like they're getting killed, and it's like just being brushed aside, like they really just don't care.
And with the general election ahead, Illinois Republicans are looking how they want to identify themselves in 2018. But in some areas, there are GOP candidates who have a history of hate. Take GOP congressional candidate Arthur Jones, a Holocaust denier.
We've tried to do everything we possibly can to prevent this person from getting on the ballot.
That's Illinois GOP Chairman Tim Schneider on WBEZ. We talk about what this means for the GOP. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to news about gun violence in Illinois, Chicago dominates the conversation, but we know all across Illinois, communities face their own challenges on this issue. Take central and southern Illinois. One data sample from eight cities in that region found that at least 100 people have died from gunfire in the last 3 years, and at least 500 others were wounded. Today, we're going to focus on Peoria, where on the city's north side, there's the campus off Bradley University on what's often called the Hilltop. And at the bottom of the hill is South Peoria, a majority African-American neighborhood. Cass Harrington is a freelance journalist based in Peoria. She's been reporting out a story about gun violence in Peoria for the Illinois Newsroom. It's part of a series that's been coming out this week about what gun violence looks like all across Illinois. Cass is with us in our studios in Urbana. Hi, Cass. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Nyla. Good morning.
Good morning. So, Cass, I just was sort of laying out the differences between North and South Peoria just geographically, and I think there's also other divides that were highlighted recently. And I wanted to ask you about some shootings that happened early last month. There were two shootings, one in South Peoria and one in Bradley, and local media called it, quote, the bloodiest stretch of violence in years. The university said it was the first time a student had been shot and killed. I wanted to just ask you about those stories and how you think, particularly even the media coverage, reflects the differences between how violence in those communities is handled.
Sure. Before I kind of tell that story, I want to get at that superlative, bloodiest stretch of violence, because it seems kind of sensational when you're talking about homicides in Peoria. It's a city where it typically sees less than 20 shooting deaths a year. And so this was three homicides in a single weekend. And, you know, if you're in Chicago where, you know, that might not seem like that many. Of course, one is one too many, in my opinion. Imagine if this happened proportionately. So Chicago is like 29 times the size of Peoria. If you multiply 29 times three, so three homicides, that would be 90 in a weekend. So that's the scale in terms of coverage. So that's why I think media was quick to say the bloodiest in several years. What happened exactly? These two shootings, they were in two different parts of the community. As you described, there's a hill. At the top sits Bradley University. And so at the bottom is South Peoria, a distinctly less economically advantaged community. So it was a Saturday night. There was a shooting around 10:45 that evening. And a young man, 29-year-old, was found dead in the street with 10 bullet wounds in his body. So police responded, you know, he was found dead at the scene. And then about 5 hours later, there was another call about a shooting at a house party just a few blocks away from Bradley's campus. And two young people had died, both. The youngest was a freshman at Bradley. She was 18 years old. And the other was another young man in his 20s. And it got at just significantly more media coverage. And shortly after, in fact, in a matter of a few days, a suspect was identified. And here we are a month later, and the young man who died in the south side of Peoria, his name is John W. Bell III. He still, you know, has yet to have anything published about his life or his family, and there is no suspect identified in this case.
And I wonder if we can also talk about the segregation between the two communities. What does that look like?
Well, it looks like several things. for the most striking thing that I bring up in the story that just went live this morning is the hill. When I moved to Peoria, I've been here 3 years, and I was very struck by this physical change in the landscape. You can drive less than a mile, maybe even half a mile, from one community to another, and what's separating them is a hill, a change in elevation. And so at the bottom of this hill is the 61605 zip code, and it's one of the 100 poorest zip codes in the country, predominantly African American and minority. And dealing with, you know, higher rates of poverty, community divestment, and just a lack of opportunity for kids and social mobility. And then at the top, it is so striking to see this beautiful historic neighborhood with old mansions that once belonged to the whiskey barons from when Peoria was a big distilling city. And so there's that visual divide, and that kind of also steeps into colloquialism. So people will say, don't go down the hill. Or if one time I was working a career day at a school, Treewind Elementary School on the South Side, and a child, when I asked, well, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? The kid looked at me straight face and said, I want to get over the hill. And of course, not being from the area, I didn't realize immediately, oh, this kid is talking about this literal hill where they see prosperity on the top.
That's freelance reporter Cass Harrington. She's talking about some stories that she did. There's a series about gun violence in Illinois put out by the Illinois Newsroom. We will tweet out that story that just went live this morning. We're focusing on the divides within Peoria when it comes to gun violence and the way that it's talked about between North Peoria and South Peoria. The south side of Peoria has actually lost a significant number of residents over the past few decades. In fact, it's about half of what it was in 1970. And I wanted to welcome a few more people into this conversation. Both of them spoke with Cass for her story. They're both Peoria residents. Abigail Irby lives in South Peoria. She's on the line with us along with her daughter, Jashonda Dunnigan, both of them from Peoria. Welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me, ladies.
Thank you.
Abigail, good morning. Can I ask you what first brought you and your family to South Peoria?
Well, what happened was, there was a community active lady, Ms. Mitchell, and she had came to me and asked me, did I want to be a homeowner? And I told her, yes, I did. And then she told me, well, my home would be located on the south end of Peoria. And I told her, oh, well, that's okay with me because I never lived on the south end. When I was a kid, I wasn't even allowed to go on the south end. But I felt like this was a advantage for myself and my children. And one thing that I was taught is not where you live, it's how you live. And so she told me that I was a positive influence, and she liked the way I took care of my home, even though I was renting at that time. And she liked the way that I cared for the neighborhood. So she wanted me to go to the South End to be a positive influence.
And what year was that? When was that, Abigail?
It was in 2000.
Okay. Jashonda, what was it like, your memories of growing up in South Peoria? What are your memories of that?
Really, in 1998, I graduated from Woodruff High School. My mom said we had never really been on the South End of town. And so at that time, I was going off to college, which was in Jefferson City, Missouri, to Lincoln University. So I would come home during spring breaks, summer breaks, all of that mainly. Living on the South End, in the beginning, there was probably some fear and hesitation because, like my mother said, we weren't allowed to be on the South End. Yes, I knew Manuel High School. I had relatives that went there. I had friends who attended there, but it wasn't like I was on the South End. So going there was a fear, like, oh, wow, what would happen if we're down here living? Will we get caught up in any trouble or anything? But when we moved down there, no. My mother was basically an example down there. Many people respect her when we moved down there and still to this day respect her. And so as being so, we had adults who watched over my brothers and myself and made sure we were still doing the right things, even if my mother was not around. We also became laughter. We had so much laughter around it. It's like it was a family unit on our street. And most of the people who lived on the street, they were homeowners. They were everyday people just like us who just wanted to be successful.
And Jashonda, to that point, I understand that you and Abigail and the rest of the family meet for a huge dinner every Sunday. How tight-knit would you describe the community?
The tight-knit of the South End, I think this is a wrong stigma that people really have. The South End is like a family. They are tight-knit. South End does not really, to me, look for trouble. There may be trouble. But sometimes trouble comes that way. Let's take, for instance, you have sometimes the hilltop that comes down to the South End that mess, and you have the north side that comes down to the South End and causes trouble. And also you could look at maybe sometimes, I'm not trying to say this, but I am, you can have people who are running from Chicago to the South End because they have situations up in Chicago they're trying to get away from. So that is it. But the South End, that is a tight-knit family. Everyone looks out for everyone down there, and they will speak up. Now, when it comes down to murders down there, I don't understand why no one wants to tell the police the truth. And maybe there's a breakdown between the police department and the South End of town. Then maybe the trust is just broken there.
Right. We're talking with Jashonda Dunnigan and her mother, Abigail Irby. They're talking about the South End of Peoria. We're talking about differences between North and South Peoria, particularly when it comes to gun violence. Abigail, and I wanted to just ask you, I understand that you all lost a loved one to gun violence. James Anthony Irby, Abigail, your son, Jashonda, your brother, died in September of 2013 along with his girlfriend, Camber Beard. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jashonda, can you share, I mean, what his absence has felt like?
The loss of my brother, even though he was my baby brother, he was my best friend. We looked out for one another. And not only that, we're a tight-knit family. My brother, him, myself, and my mother have always been us four. The loss for him is massive. I got a call last night from a family member about their child who was just three at this time, outside playing yesterday because the sun was out, and she could remember him being able to walk up to the street and say hi to her. Well, she was crying clean because she missed him. This has not only hurt us, it has hurt our entire family. His children are lost without him. They feel like they have no direction and no one is here to protect them. This hurts. Even though we walk with our heads up high because we have to trust God, he makes no mistakes. This will all work out for our good, but it still hurts. It's a pain. You don't get over it. You learn to live through it. But just the sight of a bird flying by or a song coming on makes the memories pop up of how you wish till this day he was still here and that another man or men did not take his life.
And what has what's happening with his death? Has there been the case been resolved or looked into by the police?
Well, the case.
Go ahead, Abigail.
Can I speak?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the case, in the beginning, we were told so many things that was going on with the case. But I feel like the police department kind of like dropped the ball on us because all of the suspects that were being told to me that were involved, they say that it was just hearsay. And then still to this day, we have people being arrested, but they're not being arrested for the involvement with my son. I was told that guns have been confiscated. These guns were used to murder my son. But nobody has been actually pinpointed because I feel like Peoria Police Department really didn't care. And Chief Mitchell, I was communicating with him very good until he retired. And so when he retired, I just felt like my hands was up in the air. But I kept saying, I'm trusting God. and just trusting God, because God will bring justice as long as I keep believing in Him, because my faith is just that strong. And I'm thankful for still having a living mother, because my mother's strength is what keeps me going. And then her strength that is within me, it helps me keep my children going and my grandkids. So it's hard. It's hard.
It sounds like, yeah, I'm sure it's very hard. I can hear that in your voice, and it can't imagine how difficult it must be. We're talking to Abigail Irby and Jashonda Dunnigan. Jashonda, do you feel like, especially as we started this conversation talking about the most recent shootings that happened last month at Bradley University, do you feel like shootings are treated differently depending on whether they're in North or South Peoria?
I do feel that way. I do feel there is, like I said, there's a breakdown somewhere. And there has to be an open dialogue between Peoria Police Department and the South End of town, as well as the North, East, Bluff, Hilltop, everywhere. Because there is a breakdown. What happened up at Bradley is saddening, true enough. But in the very beginning, there was not much communication either. No one was speaking on that incident. But soon as the media started covering it and saying, hey, there's no one speaking, we can't get much feedback, finally someone decides they want to come forward and speak up. Well, when it comes to the South End of town, most of the time people are saying, and my brother wasn't even murdered on the South End of town, let's get that straight. My brother was lived up there basically in the central part of town, off of university, where there was homeowners at. He lived in that area. Everyone that lived on that block said he was no problem. He looked out for the elderly up there. He moved up there to give his children a better opportunity with schooling and everything, to see a difference from the South End of town.
Jashonda, I'm sorry to cut you off for just a second. We're going to have to take a break, but when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation with Jashonda and Abigail talking about Peoria. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about gun violence in Peoria, the differences between North and South Peoria when it comes to incidents as they happen. Cass Harrington has been reporting on this. She's a freelance journalist based in Peoria. She's been reporting on this for the Illinois Newsroom. She spoke with, I'd like to play some audio from some of Cass's reporting. She spoke with a woman, Sarah Figures. Her boyfriend is John Bell III, who died in a shooting last month in South Peoria around the same time that there was an unrelated shooting at Bradley University. And here's what she told Cass about the way shootings are treated differently depending on where you live.
So, like, the police make a separation of it. On the bottom of the hill, it's not, they're not as worried as much, because they feel like it's just going to continue to happen even if they can solve the murder. So they don't put as much effort into it as they would something on top of the hill.
That's Sarah Figures speaking to Cass Harrington. We also heard, we've got with us on the line from Peoria, Jashonda Dunnigan and Abigail Irby, both of them from Peoria. Cass, just to Sarah's point, and we heard Jashonda make a similar point, when you talk to folks in the community, is that a common sentiment?
It is. It is that there's this, there's almost this sense of isolation. And really what I wanted to get at is this cynicism that it seems is woven into the narrative that someone affected by a shooting, whether a victim or, you know, a perpetrator or, you know, an innocent bystander even, is somehow affiliated with violence, that they're a bad person. And yet that even if that is the case, as we just heard, you know, you from a family who's still aching 5 years later after the fact, it doesn't detract from someone's pain. And so here with a story about the South Side and what Sarah is talking about is she is aching. She's had this void in her heart for the past month. And yet she just doesn't feel like anything's moved forward in this case. Now, I did speak with police, actually got a statement from them yesterday, and they said that they're just continuing to investigate and look for leads, but so far nothing's turned up.
Shoshonda, you said you'd like to see more open dialogue. What else would you like to see?
I would like to see, as for when we as family members, we're always told when we go in with information, it's hearsay. In the very beginning, and I know people have paths. I understand people don't make good choices, but we all have not made good choices in life. And I know some are worse than others. But if you have people who says, for instance, with my brother's case, so-and-so told me that this person came to their home, changed their clothes after the murder, then take that person's information and look into this. When we bring this information in and tell, say, who the individuals are, oh, well, they have a past, they haven't told the truth in the past, well, maybe this one time they are telling you the truth, take this information. That is the problem with the south end of town. Yes, most of the people in the south end of town have a criminal record. Not all, most maybe. I don't have a criminal record, and I grew up on the south end of town. My mother doesn't, but some of these people do. But if they want to give you information, just look into it, because there may be a line of truth here that can help solve a lot of these murders. And I'm not just talking about my brothers. A lot of them can be solved if they would listen to the people. And some of the people, yes, they do cause problems, but they feel like they cause a problem. It's just like a child with behavior issues. If you're not listening, I'm going to keep doing something negative until you choose to listen.
Shoshonda, I wanted to just end by asking you, as we're talking about all of this, about gun violence and inequality and what that looks like in the local context of Peoria, what do you want people to know about South Peoria that they're not hearing about?
The south side of Peoria, you do have people who are working to do better. You do have people who are trying. There's women down there and there's men down there who are going over to trade schools, who are becoming CNAs. You have everyday people. You have some people down there who are trying to become homeowners. They want to be an asset. You have love down there on the south end of town. There's not hate. There is love. There's choices sometimes that are not right, but most of the times they are trying to make the right choices down there, and they're trying to get by. They want to survive. And to hear Cass say, a baby say he just wants to make it over the hill, that is saddening, because that child should see I have an opportunity right where I'm at as well. He shouldn't have to get to the top of the hill to make it. He should better survive in his economics that he's in as well.
Both of you, I appreciate Shoshonda, you and Abigail, taking the time to speak with us. I want to thank Abigail Irby and Shoshonda Dunnigan for being with us, along with reporter Cass Harrington. Ladies, thank you for taking the time to speak with me this morning.
Thanks, Nyla.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. After a bitter primary battle between the two Republican candidates for governor, incumbent Bruce Rauner and Representative Jeannie Ives, those of us watching have been prepared for tension in the party. But when it comes to leadership, however, this week the GOP demonstrated they can figure out how to come together. Instead of risking a messy vote, current party chairman Tim Schneider and challenger Mark Shaw have agreed to share leadership within the GOP. When it comes to figuring out how to include more fringe members of their party, that's a bigger challenge. For example, the new chairperson of the GOP in McHenry County is a woman named Diane Evertson. Evertson previously served as president of Minutemen Midwest, a group the Southern Poverty Law Center has in the past designated as a Native extremist group. And you probably heard about Arthur Jones, a neo-Nazi Holocaust denier who will be on the Republican ballot as a congressional Republican candidate for a Chicago area seat this November. What does this mean for the party? That's what my next guests are here to talk about. Chris Mooney is the director, is a former director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, on the line with us from UIC, where he teaches now. Chris Roebling is a longtime Republican consultant who started a Republicans for Lipinski campaign. He's on the line with us from India. Both Chris's, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
As always, especially if you're a member of the Republican Party, we would love to hear your thoughts on this. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. Chris Mooney, can I start with you? Diane Evertson, as I mentioned, is the new chair of the GOP party in McHenry County. It's been pointed out by members of her own party that she served as the president of this group, Minutemen. Midwest Minutemen, which has been labeled as a Native extremist group. Can you tell us about what you make of her ending up in a leadership position within McHenry County?
Well, first of all, you have to be clear what the Southern Christian Law Center is saying about
Southern Poverty Law Center.
Mm-hmm. Poverty Law, sorry. Yeah. It's a nativist extremist group, not designated as a hate group. So what they mean by that is that they target individual immigrants rather than immigration policies. So these are the kind of people, now I'm not saying this person in particular, but this kind of group are the kind, you know, the Minutemen, they would stand, you know, camp out on the border and, you know, to keep people from crossing over. I'm not sure what they, you know, they camp on the border with Wisconsin or something and try to keep some of those people out. But, you know, down in the South, that's what they were doing. But more generally, what's going on, I mean, there is a wide range of political perspectives in this country. And many of them are legitimate. And people just, you know, we have a range. And both parties have a range within their groups. It used to be much broader, and you'd have, you know, sort of liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats much more commonly than you do now. But even though the parties have to some degree polarized and focused around a particular sets of issues, within the parties themselves, you have people that are on the extremes of that party. And, you know, so you are going to have some conservative Democrats, you are going to have some fairly liberal Republicans, but they're moving towards the center of the general population. It's the ones on the outside that usually give people a little bit of heartburn and give party leaders a little bit of heartburn. So, you know, it's the sort of socialists on the Antifa, that sort of thing, on the left for the Democrats, and on the right for the Republicans, you have, you know, Minutemen, in the Illinois Policy Institute, you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's just the way it's going to be. And the Illinois Republican Party has had a strong movement conservative component to it for as long as I can remember, but it's never been a sort of majority, and that's allowed them to sometimes compete statewide with moderate Republican candidates, people like Jim Thompson and Jim Edgar and things like that.
Right, and I guess in this particular, Chris Roebling, I wonder if you could weigh in here, because we're talking about someone who's in leadership for a county position, who said things like, third world hordes are invading the first world and they are taking no prisoners. Quote, if this is not stopped now, America within one generation will be a third world sewer. Chris Roebling, that's someone who's now in leadership and is the chairperson of the GOP in McHenry County. I wonder, at what point is this fringe or not fringe?
Yeah, I think that's a terrific question. And as individuals with views like that achieve party office, they become, by definition, less fringe and more mainstream. Now, I don't know this individual. I'm not familiar with everything they've said. I do know, or I did know, I haven't seen him in years, Morris Dees, who started the Southern Poverty Law Center. I interviewed him. You and I both used to work at BEZ. I interviewed him there several times and actually worked with him on a small project. And I loved the Southern Poverty Law Center 25, 30 years ago. What we see today is not what Morris put together then, in my humble opinion, and I don't necessarily take them as definitive on anything, especially because they've been categorizing a lot of very faithful, honest, true-hearted Americans as fringe haters and all this kind of stuff. That's another whole segment, which we're not doing right now. But back on the Republican thing, I agree with Chris. You know, there are different currents. There are many mansions in the Republican House, so to speak. And in Illinois, we've had traditionally a moderate split from the conservatives. And generally speaking, moderate Republicans in the Illinois context have generally prevailed. But there is a lot of anger and there is a lot of disappointment. And this whole Rauner challenge we saw from Jeannie Ives, in my humble opinion, based on only 35 or so years of participating in this stuff, was not the traditional moderate conservative fight, because Rauner had lied so much to so many people that it became a character issue. And so you saw Jeannie.
Right. Well, apart from that, though, Chris.
Really,
yeah. And I mean, I think that's a separate conversation, right? Chris Roebling, about different factions within the Republican Party. And maybe when you're thinking of the kind of ideology that Jeannie Ives represents versus Bruce Rauner, is, I think, a different conversation than what we're talking about here. Which is people who have made statements that other Republicans have said that they completely disagree with. In the case of Diane Evertson, we have a Republican, David McSweeney, who's been calling on Governor Rauner to apologize for meeting with her. And I wanted to ask you actually also about Arthur Jones, who ran unopposed in the primary for the 3rd District seat. This is a congressional district that includes parts of southwest side of Chicago and many suburbs. We've been talking about a lot because it featured Marie Newman, who lost in the primary to Democrat Dan Lipinski. You've become very involved in this race, which I want to hear about in a minute. But first, let's hear Arthur Jones in his own words, a man, as I said, who denies the Holocaust and has been labeled a neo-Nazi. Here's him explaining his own views.
But nothing new about me. I was involved with the National Socialist Movement and the necessity to build a wall and to keep these people out. A white racist is somebody that believes in the greatness of his people's past, the white people's past. Race mixing is, in fact, against the laws of nature and God.
That's Arthur Jones speaking on WBEZ. Yeah, Chris Roebling.
I started a Facebook page, and I would love everybody. It's called Republicans for Dan Lipinski, and you know, please go to my little Facebook page, Republicans for Dan Lipinski. If you're a Republican in Illinois, for that matter, Maine to California to Alaska to Florida, just please go there, like the page, sign up. You know, I'm not running an actual campaign for Dan Lipinski, who I know and is a very nice guy. And like Chris was saying, he's a remnant. Dan is a remnant of the days when there were conservative Democrats, and you know, there are remnants of when Republicans had liberal Republicans. But Dan is being challenged by an individual that has nothing to do with the Republican Party.
And certainly the GOP tried to stop him, right, from getting on the ballot for some time.
We spent a fortune. I say we here advisedly, corporately, or you know, collectively, we spent a fortune to get him off the ballot a few years ago. This time, nobody was watching. Everybody was worried about the establishment was worried about Rauner. The insurgents were worried about Jeannie Ives, and this guy kind of snuck in. There's actually a little story about the pro-life movement, which I don't know if it's received any. The pro-lifers, basically, Ralph Rivera, who's a pro-life leader in Illinois, sent out letters and encouraged Republicans not to vote against Jones in the Republican primary, but to switch parties and to vote in the open Democratic Party for Lipinski.
Oh, right, because it was such a close race. Mm-hmm. And so that's your concern, that that's also
being challenged by a pro-choice woman.
Right.
And Ralph Rivera probably should step down from whatever leadership role he still has, because that may have cost Jeannie Ives the nominee. But I'm against it. I don't like people like that. The comments that you make about the woman in McHenry, I'm against people who say things like that. But this guy Jones is a Nazi. You can tell from the thank you for running that clip. He doesn't deserve one Republican vote. I hope he gets no Republican votes. And I urge everybody who can hear my voice to go like my little Facebook page.
Chris, we have to take a break, both of you. Yeah, let me stop you there. We have to take a break. But when we come back, we'll pick up this conversation on the other side of that. If you just hold that thought for a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about fringe elements of the GOP in Illinois with Chris Mooney, who teaches state politics at UIC, and Chris Roebling, longtime Republican strategist who started the Republicans for Dan Lipinski Facebook page, which he's just been telling us about. Chris Mooney, as we're looking at the big picture here, do you see Arthur Jones as a random occurrence or an element that the GOP in Illinois should be concerned about?
No, I mean, you know, he's not representing a significant faction of the Republican Party. I think it's safe to say. I think he's a rogue nut job that is trying to get on the ballot over and over again. And this time, I think what this episode, the only thing that this episode demonstrates is that the Republican Party was asleep at the switch. It's the party or apparatus is one of their jobs to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen and to kind of keep an eye on these races. Yeah, are the Republicans going to beat Lipinski, even if, you know, if they put up a more traditional candidate? It's probably unlikely. But at least you have to represent, you know. I mean, and this is what happens when somebody's not paying attention. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not like there's a sub – I don't think so, and maybe Chris can correct me, but I don't think there's the secret cabal of Nazis in the Illinois Republican Party. Well, certainly,
right. Chris Roebling, you've talked about leadership that needs to step down because of this happening. But I wonder, when we think about the discussion about anti-immigrant or racist rhetoric on the national stage, how much does the impression of a party on the national level influence local perception? Chris Mooney, do you think voters make a distinction between national GOP politics and Illinois GOP politics?
Not really. In fact, voters don't tend to make a lot of those subtle distinctions that those of us, I'm sure, in your audience are. For example, one of the other than party identification, the most important impact on a vote for a governor when there's an incumbent governor who's the president of that governor's party is the popularity of the president and not the governor. Which seems weird. And the national economy has a great impact on voting, more than the state economy for individual voters. So, yeah, people aren't making those kind of close distinctions.
And Chris Roebling, would you say, though, you think it's unfair to say that hate groups have been a part of the direction of the GOP of the past couple of years, as we're talking about these particular instances?
Well, I don't think that hate groups which have, for whatever reason, associated themselves for whatever reason with Republicanism over the last couple of years haven't come close to the level of involvement and reliance that we saw between the Democratic Party for 100 years and the Ku Klux Klan. So, you know, the Ku Klux Klan was a CUDS force, if you will, of the Democratic Party against Reconstruction and against the 14th Amendment. And, you know, it was entirely constructed by Democrats to preserve Democratic power in the South and to eliminate the radical Republicans, including many African Americans who got elected to Congress. So we've got a big racist history to deal with, and all of us, each of us, every one of us, have got to do it every day, Democrat and Republican. I think there are a lot of Republicans, I think there are a lot of independents today who look at, say, crime in Chicago, specifically shootings, after 8 years of Obama and say, What exactly did the Democratic Party do for Chicago, hometown of the president, Barack Obama? And then you get guys like Kanye West coming out or Democrats attacking Candace Jones, or I forget her first name. Her last
yeah,
name,
but, well, so Chris, you know, bringing it back to Illinois. Yeah, let's bring it back to Illinois and to the specific case.
My point is that the perception, there are lots of perceptions about all of the parties, and I don't think extremism has a home in either.
And certainly not within the GOP. Chris Roebling is a Republican strategist who started the Republicans for Lipinski Facebook page, as he's been talking about. I want to thank him, along with Chris Mooney, a state politics professor at UIC, for being with me. Gentlemen, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks.
Thank Bye-bye. You.
Thank you. On Monday, Governor Rauner announced that Illinois should be able to bring back the death penalty to execute people who kill police officers or commit mass shootings. He proposes this as part of an amendatory veto of gun legislation, along with several other measures. Illinois lawmakers can either vote to accept the changes that the governor has proposed or try to override the veto altogether. They'll have 15 days to do so once the House formally receives the governor's veto message. Just a reminder, Illinois abolished the death penalty in 2011 under then-Governor Pat Quinn. That process took more than a decade and included a moratorium that spanned three governors. How quickly could something like this get reinstated and why? Governor Rauner says that bringing state execution back for certain cases will, quote, dramatically improve public safety. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. You can tweet us to 21STShow. But joining me to talk about this is Karen Daniels. She's the director of Northwestern Law School Center on Wrongful Convictions. Karen, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Karen, Governor Rauner has said he wants to create a new homicide category called death penalty murder. This would apply to adults who kill police officers or more than one person. He's added that guilt in this instance must be determined beyond all doubt rather than the standard reasonable doubt. Can you explain to us what all of this means?
Well, maybe not. But
from a legal standpoint, is there precedence for this?
Of course. So the two most prominent aspects of the proposal are, as you mentioned, it has only two eligibility factors for the death penalty. At the time the death penalty was abolished in 2011, there were 20 eligibility factors. But I have seen Governor Rauner give comments this week saying that he's open to adding more. And that tends to be what happens with death penalty statutes, is that they start with a few eligibility factors and then they get added. So they keep getting added on every year. So I don't see that as being very significant. The other part of it is that under the proposal, the death penalty would not be imposed unless all of the factors, the criteria for the death penalty are established, and this is a quote, beyond any doubt. So that's telling me two things. First of all, it's really an admission in the proposal that we haven't gotten it right in the past in death penalty cases and in murder cases. And that's true, and that's good to recognize that. The fact that we have no death penalty results from the fact that in the years leading up to the abolition of the death penalty, we had more cases where innocent people were freed from death row than we had people who were executed. We had a very high, unacceptably high error rate in death penalty cases, and we continue to have a high error rate in murder cases. But getting back to the statute, so he recognizes that, and he says, well, then we'll only do it when we can say beyond any doubt that the person is guilty and the person is eligible for the death penalty. And it's just a fiction. It is not a standard that is in use in this state or anywhere that I'm aware of. And it's a human system. Human beings decide who's guilty, who's not guilty, how strong the evidence is, and human beings are fallible. So you can say beyond any doubt, but you're still going to have different people disagreeing over what that means, and you're still going to have error.
And Karen Daniel, I'm speaking with Karen Daniel, who's director of the Northwestern Law School Center on Wrongful Convictions. You mentioned the past of Illinois' history of this. I wanted to also just ask you about what we see across the country. Illinois, as you mentioned, abolished the death penalty in 2011. What are we seeing nationally in terms of other states and their implementation or their dismantling of the death penalty?
Well, we still have 31 states that have death penalty statutes on the books. So that still is the majority of states, although it is fewer states than used to be the case. But what we are definitely seeing is a reduction in the number of executions over time. The peak year in the past four decades. In the mid-70s, the United States Supreme Court invalidated the death penalty statutes of every state, saying you have to rewrite them because they're unconstitutional. So all the states had to start over. So between then and now, the peak year for executions was in 1999, in which there were 98 executions nationwide. But they've been steadily declining since then, and last year there were 23 executions nationwide. So death penalty statutes are still on the books, but the death penalty is being sought less often, it's being imposed less often, and it's being carried out less often.
And from a legal standpoint, how hard is it to prosecute a death penalty case these days?
Well, again, for the reasons I've mentioned, maybe I haven't mentioned the reasons, but it's being sought and imposed less often.
Is that because of the cost? Right. I was wondering in terms of reason. It sounds like there's also just a trend against it, but also is this a very expensive process?
Well, it's a very expensive process. And the expense is there regardless of how often you impose it. If you have a state in which you have a death penalty, you have to have an infrastructure for the imposition of the death penalty, and that's very costly. And so, for example, in Illinois, when we had the death penalty, we had to establish and maintain a capital defense bar because we required that attorneys on both sides in capital cases have extra qualifications to do those cases. We had a capital litigation fund because we felt that both sides should get extra money for investigation and experts in cases of that magnitude. We had special state agencies to represent death row inmates in their appeals and in their post-conviction matters. And all that infrastructure had to be there, no matter how often the death penalty was actually imposed. And the fact is that in the majority of cases, when the death penalty is sought, either it's not imposed or later it's overturned on appeal. But the studies that I've seen show that states that have a death penalty spend well in excess of $20 million a year to maintain a death penalty than they would if they simply took all those cases and imposed sentences of life without parole. And that includes the money they spend on incarcerating people. So it's very expensive to have a death penalty. And in Illinois, when we abolished the death penalty, we took the money that we used for the capital punishment system and we moved it to victims funds and law enforcement funds.
Oh, so that's been the case.
We'd have to get that money back from somewhere. So that is, besides the inherent error in any death penalty system, it's expensive.
And when you say inherent error in the death penalty system, Karen, can we just end on that? We don't have very much time, but can you just explain that?
Well, sure. Again, Illinois is a great example. During the period of time when we had the death penalty, we executed 12 people. Before the moratorium in 2000, we had exonerated 13 people. We had let 13 people out of prison, off of death row, based in whole or in part on evidence of their innocence. And between then and now, we've had additional exonerations. So out of the 300 or so death penalty sentences that were imposed since the mid-70s, to date, 20 of them have resulted in exonerations based on innocence. And for the ultimate punishment, that's a really high error rate. Last year in Illinois, we overturned 17 murder convictions. This year so far, we've overturned another 7 convictions. So we get it wrong frequently enough that we should not be playing around with the death penalty again. And we went through that process. The error rate in convictions was one of the main reasons why our legislature abolished the death penalty in a bipartisan vote. And that's where we should leave it.
That's Karen Daniel, director of Northwestern Law School Center on Wrongful Convictions. Karen, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Nyla, thank you so much for having me.
The governor's version of the guns bill with this amendment now goes back for a vote in the House and the Senate. We will keep you updated on this station. Stay tuned to that for details on that as it unfolds. That does it for us today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information on what we are talking about on past shows, how to get a hold of us. If you'd like to give us feedback, we'd love to hear from you. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a good day.